The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to first-time novelist Joel Fishbane, author of The Thunder of Giants. It's a story spanning an entire century, two countries, and, most importantly, the lives of two women, each almost 8 feet tall. Stick around, and be nice to P.T. Barnum if he ever comes knocking on your door. He might be your last resort. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Daily Motion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of extremely tall fans of the show who can't seem to stop fidgeting in seats that we now realize are a little small for them in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Is Joel Fishbane's first novel, The Thunder of Giants, more fact or fiction? To be honest, I hadn't even considered the possibility that any part of this fascinating novel about two nearly 8 foot tall women a generation or so apart, could be based in fact until I finished reading it and perused the back cover, the description of which says that the book blends fact and fiction. And sure, I could just Google Anna Swan and Andora Kelsey, but somehow I thought it would just be easier to quiz the author. So you know what my first question will be. Now, if you're looking for something that will challenge you as a reader of fiction, a story that bounces back and forth perhaps between time periods, includes trips to the P.T. Barnum Museum in Manhattan and early Hollywood while featuring two most unusual women, The Thunder of Giants might be right up your alley. Joel Fishbane, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. And okay, let's eliminate any suspense. How much of Thunder is real? How much is invented?
Andora Kelsey is a fictional character. So that entire storyline is... all the characters are fictional, but the various things they encounter are true. So obviously the places in Hollywood they go to are true. She travels on the city of Los Angeles, which was an actual train that would have taken her there. So it's sort of like that's sort of more classic historical fiction where you have fictional characters in an actual historical world. As for Anna Swan, she was 100% real. She actually did exist. She did marry Martin Van Buren Bates, who was also an 8 foot tall Confederate war hero. And so I would say when it comes to her life, you know, 80 to 85% of what you read is generally true, which sounds like I'm kind of like hedging my bets a little. But, when you're writing this sort of stuff, you have to kind of make decisions about what you keep and what changes. So I fudged some of the dates, for instance, and I also fudged how Anna and Martin met. So they actually met while they were both still in New York at a party, which I think was being held at the house of Sir Winfield Scott, who was another Civil War hero. Don't quote me on that because I can't remember. I'd have to check my notes on that one. But they definitely met in New York at a party, and then they met again on the ship to London. I just had them meet on the ship to London without doing the party in New York. So it's like little things like that. But I would say that hopefully the spirit of everything is definitely true. She definitely did have a monkey named Buttons, which, you know, was such a fun fact. I had to keep it. So I don't know. I mean, I sort of also hesitate to go through and itemize every single thing that I changed or fudged because, you know, one of the fun things about Anna Swan is that she kind of lives in that world of myth. P.T. Barnum, you know, said all sorts of things about her, and he would say she was like 8 foot tall or 8 foot one, and then you read other articles and they say she was 7 foot seven. And so it's sort of like everyone was always fudging details about her anyway. I figured that it was almost right that I do the same. And that at the end of the book, if you walk away kind of going, I wonder how much was true. I feel like that's exactly what you walk away with when you research anything about Anna Swan.
And where did this, I mean, how did this even hit you as something that you wanted to do?
I do a lot of reading, and I was reading P.T. Barnum's autobiography, Struggles and Triumphs, which was a bestseller of the 19th century. And, you know, it's a pretty good, I mean, it's a pretty good book if you like, I don't know, I kind of enjoyed it. It's all about the circus and his kind of, he was a very interesting, colorful character. And anyways, he had one paragraph where he talked about Anna Swan, and he says she is by no means an ill-looking girl. And I just thought it was a very odd phrase. And I was also, being from Canada, you know, I was kind of like, why have I never heard of this 8-foot-tall woman from Canada? So off I went to the internet. And that sort of did the rest. And usually what happens with me is that I'm usually working on a bunch of different things at once, and then, or I have just a bunch of different ideas floating around in my head, and then they just kind of amalgamate together. And I was working on a story about Andorra, who was just a tall actress at the time in the very early draft, and so it all just sort of fit, and it all just kind of came together. And once I had that, I tried to do it as a short story. Because all my novels start off as failed short stories. Then I realized that, much like the characters, the story was too big for what I originally had in mind. And so it became a novel.
So you had Anna over here and you had Andorra over here. And somewhere along the line it struck you, you know, this may fit together better than apart.
Well, you know, I'm always trying to just be efficient. I was just like, it would just be so much more efficient. You know, I had another story about, like, the 1934 World Series, and I was like, you know, if I just put everything together, I don't have to write three separate books. I can just write one book and cut my, you know, save a bit of time.
I see. Well, it worked, obviously. You got a publisher, and you got the novel out, and it's a really interesting read. I was just amazed. I will not, when a publisher sends me something to consider, I'll just start reading it. I'll try not to really read much about it. I just want to start reading it because generally, you know, I want to read like someone in a bookstore would. If it, you know, you pick it up and you may page through it and go, wow, this really got my attention, or it doesn't. And right. So I didn't read, you know, I just figured it was fiction. Didn't occur to me that any part of it was true. So when I got to, I read through the whole book, and sometimes for these interviews, I won't even read to the end because I don't want to give away the ending, which I will be very careful of here. But this time I kept reading, and then I got to the end, I was like, what? It blends fact and fiction. Oh my God. But yeah, it was pretty interesting. You go back and forth between the time periods, which can be difficult. Now, how did you, you know, did you work out some kind of device for figuring out how to do that particularly, or did you just, you know, do it?
No, I mean, the simplest way I could have done it would be to write the novel chronologically and then shuffle the chapters around, but I didn't do it that way. No. I actually wrote the novel exactly kind of in the format that you have it. So I wrote the first chapter, which is Andorra in 1937, and then I wrote the next one, which is Anna, and then I wrote the next one, which was Andorra's early life, and then I went back, and I just kind of wrote it like that, and that actually really allowed me to sort of bounce ideas off each other. So, you know, the novel's sort of structured so that it's structured into certain sections. So you have like part one, birth and discovery, part two, I can't remember, I think it's love, but, you know, so it's kind of organized under themes. And so their lives, and then that way I really could juxtapose the two women's lives and we could see the sort of similarities and the differences between them. Because that was the whole original idea, is that sort of they each end up in a way living each other's life, living the lives the other one didn't get to live. So Anna doesn't get to have kids, and Dora gets to have lots of kids. Anna gets to be a celebrity, and Dora sort of struggles with that aspect of it. Anna is celebrated as a kid, and Dora is not. So it's sort of like they have these sort of opposites things, but at the same time there's always the similarities, because both of them are women who are struggling to prove to the world that they're more than just they're more than just giants, that they're women who just happen to be a little tall.
And how would you describe, in your mind, how would you describe each of the women physically? What did they look like?
Well, I mean, you can see pictures of Anna Swan, so I started with that. I mean, she was 8 feet tall, and I mean, well, I don't know if she was 8 feet tall, because they used to put her hair and it would make it so it would like go up and make her even higher. And I'm sure they gave her platform shoes and stuff like that. But, you know, she was immense, but she was also she was a true giant in the sense that everything was proportional. Right. And I use that also for Andorra. So basically, when you have the condition of giganticism, for instance, is usually a case where one part of the body is out of proportion to the rest. So somebody with an extra large head or an extra large hand or something like that. But in this case, when you have an actual authentic giant, it's somebody who is completely proportional. So everything is in proportion. They're just a lot bigger than you would be accustomed to. And that to me was very interesting. So I wanted to sort of go with that. So with both of them, if you just sort of take any average woman and just imagine her being a lot bigger. I guess it's almost like how you see adults when you're two or three years old, like the immensity of them. And that's kind of how I pictured them, because it's that sort of size difference. And but I also just saw them as being, you know, just women who were just very clever and very, and I tried to go with the idea that they were pretty normal, you know, that they were normal women who just, yeah, they happen to be 8 feet tall or 7 foot seven or whatever. But aside from that, you know, they're sort of just like anybody else you might meet on the street now. And so of course their size is a characteristic and informs who they are, but it doesn't define who they are. And that to me was a very important distinction.
And in Anna's case, of course, you dealt with historical record to some degree and things that were happening then. In Andorra's case, because she did not actually exist, how much did you feel you had to stick to what was real about her time period and that type of thing?
Well, I was fortunate in that. I had the advantage that I set her in. She's born in the Principality of Andorra in the year 1900. And the Principality of Andorra was a very sort of secluded, it was a very secluded country. I mean, they didn't even have roads until like, I think, 1912. And they didn't have power until like the 1930s. So they were very sort of secluded. And because they were secluded, I was able to sort of just create an almost mythical world where it was sort of, you know, that sort of fairy tale-esque, very insular, untouched by the outside world, where they have their own superstitions and their own sort of traditions and stuff. And which isn't to say I didn't do research. I read a lot about Andorra and Andorran traditions and things like that. And I incorporated what I thought was really interesting into it. But I actually felt I had sort of freedom to really create, because I could just sort of put her, not necessarily in a vacuum, but I didn't have to stick to any specific historical record with that. It became a little harder once she immigrates to America, because now I'm dealing with America in the 1920s and 30s, where of course there's lots of historical record, and she goes in this world full of, you know, theater and actors and this sort of like completely different world than she's used to. But that was also fun for me because I actually love theater. I did a lot of theater history, and I've done a lot of research into that era, so I really know the 20s and 30s and what that era was like, especially for the world of theater. So I was really excited that I got to use that knowledge, and I really just had fun, and I really had fun with that. I love Shakespeare, which is why there's a lot of Shakespeare references sort of peppered throughout the book. I guess the short answer is that it was actually a little easier because I didn't have a specific record, but I still had to do a lot of background research. I went to Detroit. I went through the Detroit archives. I sort of learned as much as I could about the world of Detroit in the 1920s and 30s. And then also the world of Hollywood in the 1930s.
I don't suppose you've read anything by Monty Schultz, who, by the way, is Charles Schultz's son, the son of the guy who did the Peanuts comics.
Yeah.
He's written, I think, three novels that take place in the same 20s and 30s kind of era. And this reminded me of that because he captures the era very well. You feel very comfortable that you're in that era, you understand it. And yet he's got these characters that you just can't, you know, you can imagine how difficult it is for them to fit in any era. I mean,
right.
I would think.
Yeah, well, and that's really interesting. I mean, you know, when you're dealing with a character like Andorra or Anna, I mean, I could have put them in any era and there would have been difficulties. I mean, there are people who are like over 7 feet tall today who probably still encounter difficulties. You know, it's thankfully probably not as bad depending on where they are, because we've become a lot more enlightened. We don't really have freak shows anymore. We don't really have that sort of stuff anymore. But at the same time, there's just, you know, natural difficulties you're always going to encounter if you're sort of dealing with that. But I really liked putting her in the 20s and 30s because it also allowed me to connect the two stories. If I put her the further along in history, I put Andorra, the harder it was for me to connect her story and Anna's story, which, as you know, is what happens at the end. The two stories sort of coalesce, and that so putting her in the 30s allowed me to do that.
I have nephews who are 6'8", 6'9", and I couldn't help but think of them a lot during the course of the story. I mean, they live in an era where, yeah, I mean, there's more men and women, more men, I guess, but that are very tall and dealing with, you know, but it's less of an issue. They stand out less because we've become more accustomed, I guess, to seeing.
Sure. And I mean, one of the really interesting aspects that I realized as I was doing the research is that Anna's husband was also like 8 feet tall. But because he was a man, he had it a little easier. He could still own land. He could still vote. He could still go into the army. He had a lot more options because, he was really tall, but he was a guy. So he sort of, in the 19th century, he still had all the advantages that were given to white men in the 19th century. Anna, on the other hand, and Andorra too, they're women. And so they, even though they're extraordinary, they still were forced into the same expectations that were put upon women of the eras in which they lived. So they were still expected to marry. They weren't really expected to have jobs. They weren't expected to do anything but sort of have kids and stuff. And so part of the book is also them wrestling with the sort of social expectations that are being put upon them and how they can't quite be what society wants them to be, but they can't be what they want to be, so they don't really know where they fit in, and that to me was really interesting.
There's a great scene, I think, that captures what you're talking about, where Anna and Martin, right, who she's going to wed, they're filling out the marriage license, and you know he can put down that he was a soldier or whatever. And she's supposed to put down occupation, and there's nothing she can put down. She's so upset about that. It's so. Now, I don't know if that was in it. That
actually is real. I actually saw her because when I went to there's the Anna Swan archives in Tatamagouche, so the North Shore of Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. And in those archives, they actually have her marriage license. And I saw that, and they actually put down under her no rank or profession. And that's totally where I got that, because that struck me as being, when I saw that, I was like, that is so symbolic of the time and era. And it's so like, what did she think of that? And how did she react to that? And so I knew I had to use that because it was too perfect a window into a really interesting moment.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, is that we don't, you know, we have no way of knowing if that upset her or not. But knowing the era that you're in now, it was very appropriate to assume that, you know, certainly today's woman, a woman today faced with that, that would be very upsetting, because you are expected to have an occupation and you're expected to have whatever, you know, putting in a housewife or, you know, whatever. It doesn't go the way, go over the way it did 20, 30 years ago. People want to describe themselves as something more. And if she couldn't express herself, you know, so to me it was a, I was kind of thinking of it as something that maybe Anna herself was not that upset about it for the time, but to write about it today, it seemed very appropriate the way you captured it. That,
well, good. Well, thank you. Yeah.
Kind of an angsty moment for her.
Yeah, well, I really, like I said, it was a really, it really struck me as the researcher when I found that. So I guess part of it is also like my own personal reaction to it.
Well,
it's kind of what I sort of gave her.
Now, something else that struck me in the reading of the book is you deal with some physical descriptions of female anatomy at different times, and we won't go into the specifics, but. Sheesh. You know, it's some of it's uncomfortable to read, and some of it, I got to ask, I mean, I wouldn't naturally, I mean, I've been around women all my life. I like women. I have a wife, but I don't think I could have described some of the anatomical things that you did as precisely, and I kind of wondered where that came from. Is that something you had to do a little research on to be able to accurately...
Well, it is. I mean, I like to, I guess, I mean, with that, you've got to kind of be, you know, as accurate as you can. I don't know. It's just, yeah, I did research, and it's just finding the right language. And I mean, the version you're reading is, you know, probably the 60th draft, right? So, I wouldn't want to go back to the first draft and see how I bothered describing anything, because I'm sure every sentence got changed. But yeah, I mean, it's a sort of, it's when you're into that area, you know, era, I should say, it's very sort of like, you want to be delicate, but you want to be precise, and you want to try to be a little poetic, but also kind of accurate. And, you know, I just tried to be as sort of straightforward, but as still literary as I could, I guess, you know, but, and hopefully it, you know, it just, it did whatever, it evoked whatever image it was supposed to evoke is all I can really hope on that front, you know?
And so, obviously, in any case, fiction or nonfiction, it evolves greatly from the way you started to the way you finish it. You're always, hopefully, your writer is attuned enough to think, okay, I got to do a better job with this, I got to do a better job with that. Did the story itself evolve, or was it just that the writing kept changing and getting...
The story shifted a little, I should say. I mean, it was sort of like there basically used to be a lot more of it. So the novel, the first draft I did was 195,000 words, which is about three times the length it is now.
Oh, my God.
Because I'd done so much research that I just put everything in. And I mean, and Dora got involved in the women's rights movement. And like, I just kind of like I said, I knew the era and I just put everything in because it was the first draft. And that's what you do with the first draft. You just put everything into the pot. And then I started very slowly taking everything out. And as you take everything out, you kind of like, okay, well, now I need to create something else and I need to do something else. But I mean, I think generally the overview, the sort of general skeleton was always the same. Anna always met a boy in Nova Scotia who she loved. And then as the years went on, she sort of realized that love was not necessarily as real as she thought it was. And Dora was always with Nicholas. She'd always sort of been... I sort of toyed with Nicholas's death, and I'm not giving anything away to say Andorra is responsible for his death, because I tell you that on page four. Right. But spoiler alert. but yeah, so I kind of toyed with that, and then how, and so it's a lot of details. But I would say the skeleton of it was always generally the same, and like I said, the structure of it, the bouncing around from Anna to Andorra and back again, that was always in place.
So the book, as we kind of wind down, the book, there's a plot in the book about Andorra making a movie of Anna's life. Sorry, and I couldn't help thinking the whole time I'm reading this, this seems like it would be something that would be very appealing to Hollywood itself to do this film. We've certainly seen in the way of giants, in the Harry Potter films.
Right, Robbie Coltrane, yeah.
Robbie Coltrane. They found a way to make him seem like an immense...
Yeah, today they could really do it with technology, for sure, yeah.
Has there been any interest in the film rights yet?
Not that I know of. I know my agent is knocking on doors on that front. I don't know if a movie just about Anna Swan would be...
Well, I mean, the whole...
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think it's an interesting era, and I think definitely technologically they could do it nowadays for sure. They could do really interesting things. But it was funny because when I was doing the book and I was like, they're trying to make a movie of Anna Swan. I was like, because I work in film also and I do screenplays and stuff too. And so I was thinking film, like cinematically, I was like, this, I'm not sure Anna Swan's life would make a good movie by itself. Like, you know, which is kind of why they kind of come to that conclusion in the book too. And again, I don't think I'm ruining anything by saying that, but, I do agree that it would definitely make a really interesting film, and I would love to see them do something, you know, through the magic of technology to put Anna and Endora both on the screen. I think it would be fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I think immediately, and when I get to the end, I thought about it again. The story of these two almost 8 feet tall women, as they're described, their story and the parallelism and their lives. I think it'd be fascinating. It'd be a great challenge to a filmmaker who would have.
Well,
to think.
We'll just I'm sure that we will get all the big Hollywood execs will watch this video, and they will call me up, and I will send you a very nice thank you note when they fight over the movie rights.
Checks are better.
Yeah, well, of course.
All right. Well, listen, folks, you can find Joel Fishbane's first novel, The Thunder of Giants, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can pre-order it right now, or order it. I guess by the time you see this, it will be officially out and available at a great price at MrMedia.com. If you're watching today's show on MrMedia.com, somewhere to the left or right underneath Joel, you will see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. You can download it as an ebook, have it instantly, or you can order the physical book. I understand Amazon has drones now. They can get it to you in 30 minutes or less.
Yeah, there's also going to be an audiobook coming out at some point, so you can look for that too if that's your preference.
There you go. So it's available. Click on it now. We appreciate that. And so for the website, they can go to joelfishbane.com, correct?
That's right.
And it's FISHBANE.com.
That's right.
And Joel, I looked today, so I know you are on Twitter and you are on Facebook.
I am on Twitter. I am on Facebook. I am on Instagram. So you can find me. If you're on Instagram, I'm The Great Writer. But otherwise it's at Joel Fishbane for Twitter, or just find me under Joel Fishbane for Facebook.
It's amazing, all the people on Instagram, and you were still able to carve out the name The Great Writer. Good for you.
I know, it's amazing. I was like, how has nobody taken this yet? And then I put it up and everyone was just like, boy, you're arrogant. And I was like,
well, that's why nobody took it.
How do you not get that? So it just actually made me feel old is really what happened. That was the result.
I think you nailed it. That's why nobody had taken it. It's
yeah,
just
exactly.
A little over the top, you know.
That's right. That's right. I'm too old for Instagram is really what it comes down to.
That might be it. Well, listen, Joel, thank you so much for the book. We enjoyed reading it. And thanks for joining us at Mr. Media today.
Well, thanks for having me. And, you know, happy reading.
Hi, Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Weekday mornings right here on the Realm Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the George and Tony Entertainment Show. Prepare for awesome mediocrity.
We're the Cousin Oliver of the Realm Network. I'm George.
And I'm Tony.
And we're a weekly family-friendly podcast about pop culture.
From our point of view.
At RealmNetwork.com. The George and Tony Entertainment Show. From the Realm Network.
This is Snake. Do you read me, Otacon?
Loud and clear, Snake.
Did you listen to the latest episode of the Gaming Marathon on the Realm Network?
Of course. They really know their stuff about gaming, especially that Usid guy.
Yeah, but that Chirac guy is a real jerk. I don't like him.
Regardless, their reviews are spot on and they tell it like it is.
That's for sure.
What happened, Snake? Were you spotted?
Nah, it's just Lowell Meltzer crying about the O's again.
Close call.
I better continue the search for Metal Gear, but keep listening to the Gaming Marathon each week.
You got it, Snake.
New every Monday afternoon right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said that they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. These are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.